Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, James Jones. It's March 31st, and Nintendo has officially given up on the console business and is now just making mobile games, mobile lifestyle apps. Joining me today, Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Hello. Are we actually, does anyone have Mitomo as their new business? Because I just want to say very quickly, an old iOS device, and it chugs playing Mitomo. And I think it would be very, very ironic if Nintendo made me buy a new Apple hardware. But anyway.
Thank you, Guillaume. Mr. Greg Leahy.
Happy new fiscal year, everyone. It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Your intros are supposed to be pretty straightforward, but they've just turned into a shit show. Speaking of which, Mr. John Lindemann is fucking playing Mitomo during the introduction. Hi, John.
Pronunciation? Completely right.
You've been working on your vocabulary, John.
So I can't even tell. Like, what is he saying? Okay. Of course.
Why do I even do this? Like, at some point, being the host of this show is impossible. And that point is episode 370.
It's the best.
John plays with cock is the name of the episode now.
It's the best setup ever. Oh man,
is it, John? It's best setup.
So good.
I'm gonna name the episode that. You can't stop me.
I don't want to.
Oh. God damn it. All right, so now I'm worried because it's new business time. We didn't do new business last weekend. It's new business time. And I was going to let John lead off with Mitomo, but I'm scared. John?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't really even gotten into it. I downloaded it, but of course I got blocked by the fact that... you could say I got blocked.
By the fact you found a perpetual cock-making machine? Yes.
I got blocked.
You're making Guillaume do his Marge noise. You've got to stop.
No. I got blocked, no pun intended, by the fact that I had to set my me to allow being copied. So I'm just kind of going through the setup right now, and boy, this pronunciation soundboard thing it's great. I mean,
John's parents took his sit and spell from him within weeks.
I mean, it says whatever you put in there. I mean,
great.
So
I look forward to having Ascock boobs come visit my house when you set your character up.
Oh wow, it actually. So does my guy say it? My me face actually says it.
Of course.
Oh my god, that's amazing. this is the best thing ever. Yeah, that's pretty much my new business. Oh, I'm gonna be here a while. But yeah,
this is the gonzo journalism of podcasting right now.
to further the Simpsons analogy, I think John is clearly Homer at this point. So right. I guess that means me and James have to split the kids.
All right, enough of this.
I'm gonna go through this. So I will talk
come,
about
come back to me. I'll go through the tutorial. Come back around to me. I know you want to.
Do I, John? I'm scared. I'm scared if you ever get set up on Mitomo, it's all over. Nintendo's going to shut it down. The whole mobile was a mistake. It's nothing but trash, and we're going to be done. NWR Lindy. Great.
Not bad. Anyway. I'm impressed. All right, go. Please continue. I'll be busy over here.
Thank you, John. Thank you for permitting me to continue my own podcast. Anyway. I'm gonna go next first, depending on how you want to word whatever that travesty was, because I actually, you know, gave up the opportunity to have a new business segment for the good of the show last week, and I'm gonna talk about 6180 the Moon on the Wii U eShop, which is, as I alluded to last week, a terrible name because I can never remember it. In fact, I have it written down right here so I don't forget. As a primer, don't name your game four numbers and then a proper noun that you lowercase. Not a fan of that. But anyway. Basically, it is the game is you play as the moon going through puzzle stages trying to get to the sun. That seems kind of odd, but it's a puzzle platformer where very simple. Basically, there are things you can touch and things you can't. There's no falling into pits because if you drop, the game's played on both the TV and the gamepad. If you drop through the bottom of the gamepad, you come through the top of the TV screen. If you go through the top of the TV screen, you come through the bottom of the, remember that. If you go through the bottom of the gamepad, you come through the top of the TV. If you go through the top of the gamepad, you come through the bottom of the TV and vice versa, which would, it makes it even a little bit crazier. So it's like an infinite loop as you go around them. So it's not like the top of one of them is the very top and the bottom of one is the very bottom. Essentially, it's like you're on a cylinder and you're just dropping all the way back.
Yeah, it's a wraparound. Yeah.
Yeah. So there, basically the game is you have to move through these. It's kind of your standard like light world, dark world puzzle game where like, okay, some of these platforms you can move through, but you have to go to the other side to get through others. It's a lot of like on this side, I can pass through the gap, but on that side, I don't. So I have to drop down and time it. So I slide through because you just start falling faster and faster and it can be quite nerve wracking. But basically it's just avoid spikes, get through gaps. You know, there's some puzzle stuff like you have to hit these boxes and clear them out and just reach the goal on these stages. It's not a very long game. Mechanically it works fine. There's some of the puzzles that just come down to like, it's timing stuff. So there'll be ones where you have to kind of race these spikes as they go and you just have to kind of know when to drop into the area you have to bounce around in to get through. And it's trial and error-y. Now the game is very generous with restarting and checkpointing. So it's not like it's a problem, but it does take away from the game. So it never really feels like I had to get good at it. It just feels like I could just sort of brute force most of the game. And ultimately, that's kind of what I did. Mechanically, doesn't seem like there's a lot going on, but it adds little things as you go. Kind of in the same style as Block Boy. Like it gives you little things every so often that don't really change the game a lot, but they add another layer in there, a minor thing every world that you kind of have to learn to deal with. So you get a stage where it's really easy, then you get a stage where you have to do a little more complicated, all sort of fitting in the same kind of paradigm of you're infinitely falling through these light, essentially the equivalent of a light and dark world of puzzling. But I'm not in love with the game. Like I respect what it's doing. Its use of the gamepad is solid. There are moments in the game where it feels good. Like, okay, I'm getting it. This is going okay. And then you'll get to a puzzle where it's just brute force. Like you can try to maybe count out the seconds. Like I need to go when this thing is a half second from the bottom of the top screen because this spike wall is moving all the way down the top to the bottom and then back to the top or TV to gamepad or whatever, however you want to word it. This game is also available on PC, I believe, but I'm not sure how or why. Like I feel like it's so intricately tied to the gamepad TV conceit that it wouldn't be very fun. I know that people like Don really like this game. It's just not doing it for me. It's a well-made game by professionals, to borrow John's parlance.
God bless. I always like to hear it.
Like the Miitomo music. Thanks, John.
Sorry.
It feels fine. Like it's an okay game. It just never got its hooks in. And when it would start to kind of get them in there, you'd get to one of these stages that was all just kind of, did you get your timing right? Well. No, just keep trying until you get it. And you can kind of tell they know those points because the checkpoint will be right there at the point where you have to drop off to do the timing. And because it's almost instant restarts, it's just, you could just keep hitting the over button and trying until you just happen to land it at the right time. There are some moments where I had to stop and think through a puzzle, but it's just not enough. The game just needed a little bit more variety, a little bit more, you know, just something. It just needed to feel a little bit more put together, and the challenges feel a little bit more like I have to sit there and organically figure this out versus I'll just brute force it till I get it. I also want to talk about the main feature of this new business serving that I've got here, and that is the absolute banger of a game. That game, I want to make sure I get the name exactly right, because unlike 6180 the Moon, this game has too much name. Japanese Rail Sim 3D Journey in the Suburbs number 1. Which, if you can't figure out, that means there's more of these. And in fact, there are three more of these. They released
all
two,
at
three,
the
and
same
four,
time,
all last Thursday, wow, at the same time, and put number 1 on sale. previously, there was Journey to Kyoto in the same series. This kind of goes back to like the Go By Train stuff from like the PlayStation era, where there was this weird fascination in Japanese games about doing mundane things and being super, super anal retentive about it. And essentially, I actually picked up this game because one of my favorite Game Center CX ones is the Go-By Train on the PlayStation, where Arno had to be the train conductor and get basically a perfect score. and just the madness of trying to play that game, like, with perfection. The fact that they made, like, special controllers that had the brake and accelerator controls built into them for the PlayStation, so you could feel like you're really controlling the train. This game actually just does it with the touch screen or buttons on the 3DS game controller part, you know, the D-pad and the four buttons. But essentially, you conduct a Japanese train through the suburbs, as the name would imply. There's a demo. You can play the demo. But basically, you start at a stop. You get kind of a briefing on the route to the next stop. It'll say something like, there's no turns in the next stop, so you can go straight to it. This is the shortest stop on the line. So don't try to get your speed too high, because you'll need to brake too soon. Like, what? The next stop is less than 1 kilometer away, so aim for a speed of 55 kilometers an hour. Okay. And then you wait for the time you're supposed to depart the station, because this is a Japanese train. You are supposed to depart at a specific second. Don't leave too early or don't leave too late. You'll get penalized. And you release the brake on the train and you start going. There are things like you have to know when you have to drop the speed, because there are speed limit signs that warn you you have to drop to 70 kilometers through this turn. There are times you have to hit the horn because you're going over crossings. It is a weirdly anal retentive representation of driving a train. And I kind of dig it. Like, not in it's a good game, it's a terrible game. But there is something just ridiculous about the whole experience. To give you more kind of a rundown of what it is, the bottom screen is your controls. The top screen, the 3D screen, most of it is taken up by HUD, which represents what a train conductor would see looking through the windows of like a 40-year-old Japanese above ground train. Like, these aren't modern sleek subway trains. These are old busted trains that look a little beat up, look a little grimy, boxy, you know, lived in trains. So most of that screen is taken up by what is essentially the metal frame around the window. But outside, where you can see the window, keeping in mind the sun visor is down blocking part of it, is these kind of painted over pictures of a real Japanese suburban train line. So it's like photographs, you know, they retouch to make them not look so detailed. And they've been crudely thrown in 3D, very crudely thrown in 3D. And it's not video, it's just a progression of images. So when the train slows down, it just slows down the frame rate. It looks magnificent. It is it's a masterpiece. I am legitimately tempted to drop the 15 and get the full Kyoto experience. It's such a bizarre piece of thing that came out on the 3DS that it has no reason to exist. Like, there is no reason for this thing to have been released in the West, but it was, and I'm thrilled. And it was on sale this week, so, you know, have fun with that. It's not as big as the Kyoto game. It's because it's, you know, one of four. I think it's just three lines. But you know, it won't take very long to finish. Oh, it will take a long time to finish, because you have better not go past your stopping point on the station, or you will get fired. So there's a lot of just like, okay, I need to feather the brake here. Oh, I'm not slowing down enough. Let me hit the brake. Oh, I jostled the train. I'm gonna lose my job. I'm amused endlessly by this game. It's, you know, it's been a while since I've had a weird game on here, and I'm pleased to get the opportunity to talk about a weird one. This is up there. This is up there on my weird games list. Everyone should go download the demo of this game. Just to see it. On its own, the demo is something to experience. And you have the opportunity now. Go broaden your horizons, explore careers, become a Japanese train conductor on a suburban line that takes you, you know, basically from one small town to the next. The options are there. Remember, take your turns at 70 kilometers or less, or you're going to get in trouble with your boss.
So I could see this game kind of getting old kind of fast. So are there
totally.
Are there mini games to break it up, like push the mascots inside the car doors or stuff like that?
You don't leave your seat. You are the conductor.
Oh.
That is your job. You conduct this train. So there is another... For some reason, there is another game on the 3DS eShop about the Japanese railway system. We've talked about this one. Right. That's the...
Well, there's many. They just never get to them, to us, usually, right?
Right. There is another one that is, for whatever reason, available in the West. And that is the A-Train City Simulator. That one is more about, like, SimCity stuff, like managing your train empire. You get to run the Yamanote line. Have fun. Like, it's like that one's such a crazy different thing. Like, it's all about building your vertical monopoly that runs the train and runs the businesses along the train tracks and picks the spots for stations to max. It's like, that's a whole different degree of insane. This is like a small presentation. Why is this a thing insane? And I think part of breaking up Journey in the Suburbs into four chapters is to make it much more palatable. It's a lot. Those are a lot cheaper than the Journey to Kyoto. So, like, you can get that small sample you want and then get out, because this is probably there's somebody right now who is mastering that game somewhere in the U.S. and like they just managed to stop the train 0.2 meters from the stop line, and they are infuriated with themselves. And I don't want to meet that person, but he's probably going to be at PAX East wearing a hat that is luminescent depending on what angle you're looking at him from.
Oh, I see you're playing.
I see you're playing Journey to the Suburbs, Japanese Rail Sim 3D.
You realize my father was a train dealer back in the day.
That's right. My father sold Japanese trains in Sendai. Your father sold trains in Sendai? What?
Oh,
it's
man.
This game is gloriously Japanese, and I'm even down to some of the weird translation decisions that came up. It's like I said, the game represents speed by slowing down the frame rate. What? Beautiful, beautiful, absolutely just idiocy and glorious attention to no detail that I adore. So definitely go download the demo. It's 5 minutes of your time that you will be able to never get back. So on that, Greg.
Yep. So first of all, I'll mention briefly, I haven't got Miitomo. I don't think that's going to happen. I had Tomodachi Life, which seems like this is kind of a offshoot of. But yeah, this basically sounds a bit like a Tomodachi Life that you need Facebook and Twitter to work. So yeah, that kind of kills it straight out of the gate for me. Like I said, I did enjoy Tomodachi Life mostly because I just messed around with fictional characters in there. You know, you found some good Miis out there, and I made some myself and all that. So you had things like had Padme from Star Wars ended up marrying Joffrey because she has a terrible taste in men, clearly. You just can't stop picking terrible.
Well done, sir.
And Bayonetta and Walter White from Breaking Bad, who they presumably met at the opticians. That's the only way I ever really rationalized that particular Tomodachi Life romance. But yeah. Miitomo's probably not happening for me. But I did try out the My Nintendo stuff. Because obviously that went up alongside the Miitomo launch. And in Europe, they had the opportunity to download Flipnote Studio 3D for free as a reward for setting up the My Nintendo account. And that was basically like a little test of the new interface for buying stuff off the eShop on the web version of it now. And then it be automatically downloaded to your system. And that went very smoothly. Yeah. I'm pleased that they're, making strides in that direction. Finally, I haven't done a lot of messing around with Flipnote Studio 3D, although just looking at the samples, it's a nice piece of software. It's a shame. I don't think there's ever going to be any really robust sharing of stuff on there because they spend quite a lot of time making this, but I don't think evidently this is like the best idea they had to do with it after what happened with Swapnote, I suppose, or I'm not exactly sure what happened there. It's kind of sad.
And it's weird because Miitomo is so much more open, right? Like you have the possibility of befriending relative strangers, like just people who you are friends with on Twitter. So you can add them to your game and you can create photos. You can use photos on your phone as a background for like a setup with little Miis. So, if someone wants to share dick pics, it's never been easier.
John.
Oh no.
Hey man, come on. Give me a little bit of credit.
I'm just really worried about
that's
what
the problem.
I'm just really worried about what Brett Favre's me is up to right about now. Oh dear.
It's so weird that, you know, like they would close that other system because of this potential for abuse.
I guess the thing of having it piggyback off the back of Twitter and Facebook is just the fact that, well, you know, it's their fault. they brought these people together, not us. You know, all we did was provide little, you know, giant chibi avatar things.
I wonder if it not being on their system makes them feel like, well, it's not our problem.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that too. So they maybe just absolves them of some of the sense of responsibility they feel with their own products, because of it, the swap note situation. It was presumably, you know, not something that was, you know, the, all because of Nintendo, they just couldn't, you know, they didn't want to be in a situation where obviously they're very conservative and they don't want any kind of feeling of controversy. You always get silly stories when there's something about an Animal Crossing that wants some hysteria story on there. So, you know, I guess you can understand how cautious they are normally, but I suppose that might be one kind of upside about the smartphone thing, is if it kind of lets them be a little more liberal with some of these things. But like I said, not for me, but
Lord knows I will be.
Oh, yes. John will be
That's
testing.
What worries me.
John's going to be the canary in the coal mine for Nintendo and this stuff. But no, I mean, the My Nintendo account stuff and all that, it's nice to have, you know, the situation back again where we at least get some kind of credit for purchasing stuff again. Like, as I mentioned a bit ago, yeah, we had the Digital Deluxe program on Wii, and that's been away for comfortably more than a year now. So there's a few purchases I've had. You know, I was thinking I may as well wait, because let's wait until I can earn a little bit on back for credit on these things and whatnot. So nothing that early on that's hugely attractive with the offers, but I assume they're going to kind of develop and grow over time. And yeah, the whole thing about you could earn platinum points just for like signing into Miiverse every week and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, they're kind of diversifying how you're going to be able to earn rewards. And it'd be interesting to see if we ever get any kind of physical dimension to that in the West, where I presume they will in Japan. But maybe not elsewhere. We'll see. But
yeah, I kind of doubt it.
Yeah, especially in North America, because they were really winding that down very aggressively back in the end of the Club Nintendo phase.
Yeah, just before we leave the My Nintendo stuff, the rewards thing actually works really well. So I accumulated enough points to purchase WarioWare Touched. And so I bought it, and it brings up this screen on your browser, like this code that you can input in the eShop. But you also have a button that's basically like download on your system, and you click it. And if you've connected to your Miiverse account or your Nintendo account, then it just starts to download automatically. And in fact, it didn't take too long. The WarioWare Twisted downloaded while we were speaking. It's very painless, and it's such a big improvement over Club Nintendo and all the stuff that they were doing before.
No, I mean, obviously they've had this infrastructure with sort of pushing software to your 3DS, for instance, for quite a while. You know, all the Pokemon free to start stuff, you know, Picross and Rumble.
But it was not for every piece of software. Now I think they've expanded it to pretty much everything that they sell.
Yeah, that's right. Now we've got to a point where, you know, we can actually really make use of that rather than them kind of foisting certain things on people.
Like you could do it through some of their stuff online. Like, because I remember I talked about it when I did it for that indie bundle that they put together. But yeah, I mean, it was like you had to go to this very specific website and enter the information. It was really bizarre. Like, you put in the codes and they would come through. But yeah, it's nice that now it's just, hey, I want to press a button and go. But this also goes in line with the new eShop website that they promised years and years and years ago that we
now have. Been a long time coming, hasn't it? It's like I said, it's just using the free download of Flipless Studio 3D. It's really nice to see that come to fruition.
at last. At least, that's kind of the main thing that I've got out of Miitomo launch day. is all that kind of thing. But in terms of stuff I've been playing, I'll just talk quickly about an import I picked up a while ago. I've been working through very gradually, because it's not a particularly long game. It's Kuririn Squash, for the GameCube. So, as you might guess, from the name, it is part of the sort of Kuririn series. That started with the GBA game that was recently added to the Wii U Virtual Console in North America. It's been available for a bit longer over here. And in fact, actually, the original GBA cart came out over here with that name intact. whereas for some reason, they didn't bother putting it out in North America. But I always remember it doing well with people that were doing import coverage. That was a big part of this site, you know, back then, in the early phase of, you know, sort of 2001, was doing GBA import coverage, and this is one of the games that did well, you know, in terms of its recommendations, but I never did get around to it. And, so the first time I played that was when it came out on the European eShop about a year and some months ago. I enjoyed it enough to think, okay, let's look at the other ones that probably, you know, won't be ever coming out digitally because, you know, they only ever came out in Japan. There was a second GBA game called Kuririn Paradise, and then this one for the GameCube, both Japan exclusive, and both had a reputation of sort of taking that initial game, you know, somewhere a bit different, and doing something cool with it. But, the opportunity came up for this. I've been playing through it for a while, and it's very nice. I mean, it's probably a bit easier than the GBA game. The one that's on Virtual Console. You have analog control, which obviously gives you, you know, a more nuanced sort of movement, more careful movement with the world's slowest helicopter or whatever it is that you're controlling, the little bird in the world's slowest helicopter. Also, you know, you have the ability with the shoulder button now to affect how quickly it does rotate, which means that you don't have to kind of wait so much. You don't have to do so much time waiting for, like, okay, for everything. Kind of like what James was talking about to some extent with the 1680, the moon game. Sometimes in these Kuririn games where you're going around these mazes and you can't touch the walls and all that, and there's obstacles, you know, that are mechanisms on a particular kind of clock, you're waiting for a particular window to get through, but the ability to sort of speed up that rotation means that you're not going to have so much, so you could kind of just accelerate that a little bit and not actually just have to wait for it to reach that exact point. You can bring it to that exact point a little bit quicker, then go. So it's got this more nuanced, more immediate feel all throughout the controls now, which is very nice for a game that's so, you know, based on this kind of gameplay. You've got the fact that the field of view is a bit better than it was on GBA, predictably enough. I wish it were a little more zoomed out, to be honest. I mean, it certainly could be. You're talking about your polygonal graphics on GameCube here. There's no reason why it has to be as, it couldn't even be customizable, but still, it doesn't feel as cramped as GBA, that's for sure, and it's not really a problem when you go through the game. And you also get a lot more variety in this. Like, for instance, you get different kinds of craft. Like, one is a submarine kind of helicopter for some reason, where you're now working on sort of two planes. You've got parts where you'll be sort of going along on the surface of the water, and then you might reach a barrier, which means you have to submerge and go through some obstacles until there'll be something that forces you to rise back to the surface again, and then working back and forth between those layers. Actually seems like something that visually would be really nice on 3DS, but I imagine no such game would ever be forthcoming.
Right. I don't suppose that the your helipad or whatever it is actually kind of slows down in the water. That would be cool.
It feels a little different, I think, in the water. Well, the whole thing maybe feels a little different, but, you know, it's more just like a conceit to have these kind of two levels to it. It's not too preoccupied with the kind of aquatic nature of it. But right. Then you've got other ones like, for instance, you've got like a flamethrower thing, which is where you go on a rail where you can't be you, so you're not controlling it. It's just on a rail that your craft spins round on top of this thing that's on a rail, and you have flamethrowers at the end of your craft, and the only way, all you could do is just kind of control like the way it spins, and you have to use the flamethrowers to break down obstacles, to take out enemies, all this kind of stuff. So that's got a very different kind of feel to it, where, you know, you're not even really driving anymore, as it were, you know, but it's got more of an action type of focus to it at that point. And there's other ones where you kind of control a little craft that creates little tornadoes that could take out enemies and open up paths and block off like flame jets that are coming out after you, you know. So it's just nothing too radically different, but little spins on the formula, just little tilts on the formula that really kind of help inject a bit of variety. And then also each
because
world,
because there's really nothing like that in the first game. Like it's just the first game is very much just your thing spins and you get it through these tunnels and that's it.
Yeah, I like to. I mean, there's probably a certain purity to that, you know, and that comes with that, that I think quite a few people who like the series enjoy, and it probably is more sort of directly challenging. But in this case, you know, it's funny because it was the last Kuririn game, but it seems like it's the best sort of, that would be the best entry point into the series, probably, because you get the variety, it's not too challenging, and it has that kind of thing that Nintendo likes to do where it has these kind of embedded levels of difficulty where it's pretty easy to clear most levels if you just want to get to the end, but you've got coins strewn about the level, and finishing them while collecting all the coins can be a hell of a lot more challenging, especially because there's some sort of areas off the main track where you wouldn't have to go to just finish the level, but that's where it might get a lot tighter, a lot trickier just to navigate and to get all those coins. So you've got all that kind of, you know, it's kind of as hard as you want to make it. It certainly does get pretty damn tricky towards the end. And it also has some bosses, which they're generally not that tough, but they're pretty fun. You know, it could just something to add a little bit of a different feel to it, make some cool uses of those alternate crafts that I talked about, you know, including some which get very actually, like in the last world you get one that just sort of fires lasers out from it and stuff. So, you know, I really, really enjoyed this. You know, I suppose it's not the longest game in the world. Like I said, it does have multiplayer stuff, which I'll never get to see. But yeah, with all the kind of different levels of challenge, you know, getting all the coins, not getting any getting hurt or taking any damage across all the level. They've got an alternate mode after you beat the adventure, which is like you actually no longer in the sort of helicopter thing. You know, you're just a little ball at this point. But the tough part of it is now that it just slides all over the place. It has crazy inertia and it can't stop. So it's the same levels, but it has a very different feel at that point. So a really cool GameCube import that you know, I'm glad I finally got the job. I've always had my eye on it a little bit, kind of feel it's kind of a, you know, kind of sort of similar kind of enjoyment that I got something like Monkey Ball back on GameCube, you know, and it's got a similar kind of vibe in terms of your very kind of colourful, arcadey kind of feel. You know, it, I guess there really is no other way to get it apart from a Japanese GameCube disc.
I've kind of recently gone down that weird path of, there's a bunch of these GameCube games that never came out outside of Japan. Like, there's a lot of them. There's this whole line of, I want to say they're Konami published games, but I might be wrong. Actually, no, they're Hudson. There's this whole line of, which, yeah, I understand the distinction is minor. There's this whole line of Hudson published Konami, or excuse me, Hudson published discount games that came out on GameCube. Like, it's, there is a great many of them, and the GameCube collector's market in the West has really gotten to be a problem. Like, it's the prices have really started to go up pretty precipitously. And like, I've started turning my attention that way, and there's some really insane and weird and fun and kind of interesting games that came out on the GameCube in Japan that just never made it out. And a lot of the stuff doesn't need to be translated.
No, like, I mean, this is not something that, you know, it's very import friendly. It just has some kind of story seeds which are presented as being like cardboard cutouts on sticks. it's kind of a cute presentation. You're just getting all of the birds back home again, I think. But right. You know, like there's plenty of games. I mean, Mr. Driller Drillland for GameCube's really good.
That's in that list.
That's really good. And again, GameCube wasn't that popular in Japan relatively, so it's kind of weird that it has quite a lot of cool Japan exclusives, but it does. Like you said, in some ways, maybe that helps them be sort of obtainable for reasonable prices. I've certainly, while I wasn't on the show, this is the kind of thing I was doing a lot of, is sort of delving into the depths of games I hadn't played and buying some affordable Japanese GameCube games.
Yeah, there's a couple, like the Hudson Selects Star Soldier. There's a PC Genjin, aka Bonk, that I have acquired and I haven't had a chance to do anything with yet. Like, I'm actually really interested in just getting a complete selection of the Hudson selection. I mean, it's like Takahashi Meiji No Adventure Island, Lode Runner, Star Soldier. Like, these are games that, came out in other forms, but having a more modernly produced version of these games. Like, this is what makes it so frustrating that Nintendo never seemed to figure out how to put GameCube games on the Wii U eShop. Or just never bothered. Like, maybe they could do it, they just didn't care. Because there is this backlog of Japanese games that they could have released in that way that, yeah, they're going to be... They've already shown a willingness to release games that weren't translated in the eShop, virtual console. And these kinds of like weird Japan only GameCube games would be good examples. There was a soccer game from Konami. I'm blanking on what it's called.
They did have a game, that was kind of in their Winning 11 series, which became those Pro Evo outside of Japan and all. I think they got something out in that vein in Europe as well. But of course, they weren't bringing that out on the American GameCube market.
Captain Tsubasa, I think, is the game I'm thinking of. But there's also like Donkey Konga 3. Like, that never came. Of course, you need bongos,
Donkey Kong 1 and 2 are basically different games in Japan, right? I mean, all three Japanese games in that series are kind of different because of the different music choices. But the third one's interesting because it was kind of coincided with the whole GBA kind of Game Boy, GBA NES anniversary, Famicom anniversary, So.
Right.
They had like 30 Famicom tracks on the Donkey Konga 3, from all classic kind of Famicom games, and I think obviously kind of tilted pretty heavily to the Namco Bandai kind of stuff because they collaborated on Donkey Konga.
Right. Yeah, they were just there. Nintendo Puzzle Collection, did that ever come out outside Japan?
No, I don't think so. That was the Yoshi cookie, is it? And then Panel de Pon and Dr.
Panel
de Pon
and Dr. Mario. This is the one, like the GameCube is the one console generation they haven't figured out, which is a bummer because there's some really cool stuff there. Even if you're not dealing with the import market, that's it's hard to play GameCube games now. It just is. And it would be cool if it wasn't so damn hard. If I could play Custom Robo just whenever I wanted to, that would be fun. But we don't live in that world.
They put the second Custom Robo that was on N64 on the Japanese virtual console. That's the only digital re-release that's got.
But
that's it.
The GameCube one's the one you want.
So I understand.
I don't know. It's.
I don't. The thing is, though, I do like collecting physical GameCube games because the Japanese ones, because they're so cute. Those little boxes, I love them so much more than any other format. They're lovely. I'm glad to have more of them.
Guillaume.
Yes.
Talk to me.
Sure. Well, I've been playing Asheron Odyssey Untold finally, like, it's, I think it's been very obvious that I've been looking for an RPG to sink my teeth into, and
you've been looking for a Breath of Fire.
Yeah, well, you know,
There's not enough out there, Guillaume.
Right. No, but I wanted something that felt old school, and turns out that to have a good experience with an old school RPG, you shouldn't go back to middling old RPGs. You should go to newer RPGs that are inspired by the old RPGs, but that, you know, do away with all the crap that you would have to put up if you were actually playing an old RPG. So, Etrian Odyssey Untold, it's a remake of the first game on the DS, which I had never played. My first experience with Etrian Odyssey was with 4. So, I don't know, it's kind of weird, because I am taking a step back into the series that they've updated. Is anyone going cross-eyed right now? Am I?
No.
Okay.
That's just you. Are you all right? Do you need a doctor?
Yeah, I think so. So I'm
don't fall asleep. That's all I can say.
Etrian Odyssey Untold. I've talked about the demo for this, but that was episodes ago.
That was on an episode I guessed it on, I think.
Oh, really?
Was that when we did Pandora's Tower?
It's been so long. They've put out Untold 2.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So it's been like 7 months. You're saying that's usually the release window between Atlas RPGs.
Let's rephrase it. They've put out Untold 2 in Europe. That helps give it more the length of time that's actually transpired. They're getting better, to be fair. They are getting better, but that's some of the bigger lags that you see at this point between the markets with those Atlas games.
Yeah. So I've talked about the demo. Back when I played the demo, I played the story mode, which is kind of the selling point, one of the selling points of the Untold series of remakes, because Etrian Odyssey games are very light on story. They're very much kind of dungeon crawlers where you set up your party, you kind of personalize everything, customize everything, and there's not much of a plot, like just the barest thing, like, okay, well, there's this forest here, and we need explorers to explore it, so go ahead, explore it, and you know, fight these monsters. Yeah, basically, go have fun. So the story mode that they added, what I've experienced of it in the demo, I really didn't like, because as I've mentioned a few episodes ago, the whole anime dialogue thing that just never ends, you know, like characters that are uninteresting and just talk and talk and talk and say nothing. That's what they added really to Etrian Odyssey Untold. Like the story mode, it's just characters that you don't care about just prattling on and on. And so I when I started this new game, I went with the classic mode. So you don't have to suffer through any of that. Very quickly, you've set up your party, you've bought some equipment, and you start exploring the labyrinth. And, the game so far strikes me as a lot easier, and it could be because, than 4. And it could be because now I have experience with this type of game. I've played 4 and I've played Persona Q, so this is not my first time playing this type of a Etrian Odyssey game. But I think also they've added a lot of things to just make the game easier in general. I'm playing on easy. There was a picnic difficulty level that I could have chosen, but I knew that probably would have been way too easy, but like it's there. But beyond that, like even on the normal difficulty level, you unlock all sorts of stuff. Like you've got, you can have a home base where you've got this servant or this, I don't know, this maid who prepares recipes.
Oh yeah.
No, but no. So she's one of the least skeevy characters.
in an Etrian game, nobody wears clothes in Etrian games.
But the point that I was getting at is that like you can basically go visit her and you get a bonus to your stats. Like you can get pay for a very modest fee. You can get like this thing where you get back a little bit of health after each turn in a battle, or a little bit of magic points every turn in a battle. it makes things so much easier. You can stay in the dungeons for so much longer when you actually use that. And I don't think that was in the original game. I think it's specifically because they think that a lot of people find these games a little bit too hard, and they wanted to make it easy. So,
see, I always thought the Untold games that was the point. It was to like bring people into the franchise, and that's why they added more story to be more inviting to people who actually care about that kind of stuff, and why they. Mm. And I think making them a little bit easier was also part and parcel with that.
Well, I guess so. But 4 was the one that I started with. I think 4 was just kind of user-friendly enough and easy enough. Like, I never really had trouble with it. So, I don't know. I think 4 was a good starting point, and Untold might be going a little bit too far, toning down the difficulty. Or maybe I should have picked a higher difficulty. I don't know. But anyway, it's still pretty good. Like, I'm enjoying myself way more than when I was playing Breath of Fire. You know, I was talking about this friction in the battle. Like, now I'm not just, you know, exploding enemies just by running into them. Now this time I actually have to make, you know, important decisions
That's
during
ease.
Battle. You're right, yeah. Wrong series. But anyway, the yeah, I have to make, like, the decisions I make in battle matter. The decisions I make building up my party matter. And, like, it's just right. Like, the combat is fun. And, charting your way through these dungeons is a lot of fun. Like, it kind of gives me it's kind of the same feeling as I get when I'm solving a Picross puzzle, you know, just like filling up the map and then, oh, okay, like, I've got this complete picture now. And, it's satisfying. It's really, really satisfying. So, yeah, I'm really enjoying this, and I never thought back in the DS days that this was a series I would enjoy. I remember reading, like, on 1UP, Jeremy Parrish talking about his progress and how hard it was, and probably the DS games were a lot harder, but at this point, like, on the 3DS, like, they've got so much more user-friendly and so much more welcoming, and it's the perfect series for me at this point.
Guillaume's gone soft.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Like, I wanted this kind of old-school challenge, which this game still provides, but yeah, without all the crap, the bullshit that you have to deal with trying to play through a Breath of Fire game, or, you know, an old dungeon crawler, which I'm saying that, but I've never really played them back in the day. Like, I've never played an RPG that required me to have graph paper, you know, next to me and to charge my or Quest for Glory or whatever those games are. We can move on. I'm really.
I'm trying not to move on because I'm worried. I'll be honest.
I've been busy over here, man. I've been doing some work.
I've been trying to avoid. You know what? You know what? You're right. Let's move on. Let's talk about more train simulators. Let me read you about
you can't delay it anymore. I'm sorry.
The Seki line from the Narragawa Railway history. Let's not get to Mitomo.
James Jones is my daddy. James Jones.
Jesus Christ!
Guillaume likes poutine.
Seriously, Guillaume?
That's the best
Guillaume.
I can do.
Okay, you could do better than that.
Yeah, I think so.
You could in Tomodachi Life, so I'm assuming you counted that.
Yeah, I don't know what it recognizes as Gi, though, the hard Gi.
James the Jones. Hard Gi.
Why? Why am I even... All right, John, just right. Give us your dumpster fire of a segment. Let's go.
Okay, so, yeah. So, you know, I've been busy here. You know, I went through the opening tutorial, answered all the questions. The questions kind of went on forever because they just don't really stop you from answering them. I got a visit from Don Koopman. I had to cut it short, though. He had to go. He was wearing an astronaut suit. It was kind of uncomfortable. I visited this shop, and I spent, I think, 6,050 coins on an outfit, so I am now my outfit is Gothic Lolita. So I'm dressed.
Haven't they got novelty size clock necklaces yet?
Yeah, I'm waiting for a Biz Markie outfit in here. We're going to see. hopefully they do a cross promotion. But yeah, so I'm dressed in like a little kind of maid skirt. That's good stuff.
I retract everything I said about maids.
Yeah.
Maids are terrible.
Yeah, that's why I laughed out loud when somebody mentioned maids. I was like, well, you have no idea what's going on in
Don't
my...
Don't ruin cat girls for me, John.
You have no idea what's going on in my bedroom right now, James. The maid outfit has been broken out. Let's see, I've trolled several
why?
People.
Why?
I've trolled several people. I enjoyed James. Your
like
favorite.
Everybody listening to this show right now, John.
I'll get to every last one of them. Believe me. Let's see, James. I enjoyed the fact that that you said that your favorite bread was cash. That was pretty good.
Thank you.
My response was business in all caps, of course. I told Mike Sklans that FSU sucks. So that's good. Me photo. I took. Actually, how do I share my Me photos? My Me photo photos.
You can ooh, do.
Okay,
you can
Twitter. Yeah,
you
yeah.
can
oh.
tweet them.
Yeah.
So there's a share button. Yeah.
Yeah. I made a great image of. I happen to have. Now on my phone, you have to understand. I have some interesting images in my camera on my camera roll, right?
Well, we already talked about dick pics potential earlier.
No, this isn't dick pics. No, this is actually a picture.
It's not
of...
potential anymore, Guillaume.
This is actually a picture I have of Macho Man and the Easter Bunny. I don't know what the context is.
'80s wrestling, John. That's the context.
Yeah. So I'm gonna wishing everybody a belated happy Easter. Wishing everybody
wish them a happy new fiscal year. It's the real holiday.
Yeah. Happy Easter and fiscal year. What is it? Is that FY 2017? Right?
Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
Done. So if you check Twitter, you'll see what that looks like there. But yeah, so far this is pretty good.
Now playing has invaded this segment.
Yeah, so
you may as well give out the Twitter handle again, just so everybody can look up these.
The Twitter. Well, yeah. Actually, that one probably would have went out to Mr. Diamond J. Actually, I think it would have. Let me just check.
Yeah,
check.
It better not have gone out to the RFN Twitter account.
Oh, I wish it could. Well, I mean, we could. That's the thing. We could. Could we set one up?
I just want to see John's.
Wait, it did what?
I want to see John's me looking very sort of solemn next to a picture of Hulk Hogan.
Oh no, it doesn't look solemn.
In his formal bandana from the courtroom.
Jesus Christ! What? So, what?
Yeah,
why?
It just yeah. Oh yeah, happy Easter. Ooh, yeah.
Well, this is that chapter art. Thank you, John.
Oh. Yeah, sorry. Cat got kind of upset at that one, but yeah.
Oh, the cat's upset. Well, I'm glad we've got our priorities in order.
They so have got way better hearing than us, so I don't know why they put up with any of this.
So yeah, so I'm gonna play around this a little bit. Just
no, I heard that.
James Jones is my daddy.
So yeah, notifications. Yeah, this is it's. You know what? It's this game is. It's funny because it's actually like I thought it would be more lightweight than it is. There's actually quite a bit to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it takes a little while actually to load some stuff. Like it's pretty full fledged. Like I don't know really what I was expecting. I was expecting something that was kind of like almost like sort of like a web framework kind of thing. That's just you know, but. But yeah, I don't know how much I'll necessarily play it. It's but I could see myself checking in every day. I mean, if there's more skirts to buy, Lord knows I'm going to be lining up for them. You know,
yeah, I've got the E. I've got a tiny cat that lives on my back, just hanging on, and I'm wearing a skirt because I won it at Pachinko. And I'm gonna make use of it, damn it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's pretty cool. I wouldn't. I don't know. I haven't spent my points on the shop yet because there's way better stuff in the. I mean, made outfits are cool and everything, but there's better stuff at Pachinko. So.
Yeah. I had to
there
get something.
There are cat outfits to be worn and won.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I got my eye on the bear outfit, but everybody's going to have the bear outfit, you know. You know what I mean? It's just so, you know, so I went straight to...
The outfit choices should be pretty good just based on Tomodachi life. I had Joffrey in Napoleon's outfit. Mm. I thought
that fits on a lot of levels, Greg. I appreciate that.
The tomato garden look, that one's pretty sweet. You know? Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to play around with this. Ooh, you can buy socks? Cool. Oh, man. Oh, nice. They got, ooh, they got fishnet tights? Oh, man. Oh, my weekend is full, guys. I'm going to have my secretary cancel all appointments.
It's mostly the same appeal as Tomodachi Life, except that this time your stupid friends are making up all sorts of stupid answers infinitely. You know, there's not going to be the same joke repeated like once a day or more. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be like whatever they think of. And so, the stupider your friends are, the better.
Well, yeah, and I can...
So I just friended you, John, on there.
Sweet.
It has begun. The stupider your friends are, the better. Hey, John.
Yeah, I can see. The thing is, what'll happen is you'll eventually just get sick of answering questions that the way they're actually, like properly.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, I've already been tempted to answer one question with, I think the question was... What do you do to relieve stress? And my first instinct was to answer it as with heroin, but it's kind of dark. So, you know, maybe I'll do that. You know, I'll move into that probably in a couple of days. But good stuff. I'm gonna play around with it quite a bit, I think. I mean, I'll definitely be checking it every day. That's for sure. Because why not? I mean, it's a low barrier to entry. I mean, I have everything hooked up and everything. The only thing I don't think I have is, I don't know if I have it. I don't think I have it hooked up to my Facebook account, but Twitter obviously was already hooked up. MeFoto is really, really funny though. I mean,
MeFoto is going to be just
where
nightmares get made.
I mean, yeah, I can really see that. That'll be taking off pretty big, I think. I mean, it already has. So,
yeah, I mean, it's what our Twitter feed is at this point. It's just idiocy. A never ending train of just dumb nonsense is now just built into my Twitter feed.
I think over time you'll see it kind of die down for a while, but then probably in a couple of months, that's when you'll get the real creators moving in there and doing like really, really epic stuff. The people that are like, professional level MeFoto creators, you know, probably making like animated shorts out of stuff and things like that.
You mean we're gonna have like the Vine celebrities of MeFoto?
Yep, I think so.
Oh God,
yeah.
Truly, we live in the darkest timeline.
It is the darkest timeline. I'm level one now. Do you have levels for your gear? Is that what that is?
When you change clothes, you level up your fashionableness.
Okay.
Right. So I'm not sure what that unlocks. I guess you just unlock more coins and more tickets for Pachinko and stuff like that. And it's the same deal with the hearts. They're popularity points, and you get them by interacting with other people.
Yep.
Yeah, I got a reward ticket for leveling up because I put on the sci-fi suit or whatever it's called.
It listed me like when it did my assessment. I am outgoing, social, charming, energetic, comfortable in a situation, and makes new connections.
Yes,
easily.
You are the outgoing member of Radio Free Nintendo's cast.
I'm a charmer.
Loquacious.
It says that I'm a charmer. I'm outgoing, and I think you guys would all agree with this. I'm outgoing and very pleasant to be around, able to make friends easily, and turn almost any problem into a positive situation. Isn't that me? I mean, come on.
Like,
all the kids that got spat out of Tomodachi Life and I said leave it to nature as far as their personality goes, none of them came out as shitbag, even if they were fathered by Joffrey. So, you know, I don't think anybody is ever going to get that.
just immediately... kill this me, it must go.
It doesn't give you that option, does it? It's like, do you want it to stay, or do you want to send it traveling, or do you want to drown it? it doesn't give you that option, funnily enough.
One thing that I did notice, it's actually kind of difficult to find the me drop thing. Like, I thought it was just going to be like right on the front page, but like I had to kind of hunt around for it the first time.
What do you mean?
Just getting to it. Like, I thought it'd be, because it's one of the places where they can, you know, maybe get some money out of you. I thought it would be more front and center.
Mm-hmm.
But it really isn't.
Well, I mean, from everything I've read, this isn't actually making a whole lot of money. So.
No. It's to get you to sign up.
Yeah, it's kind of a soft sell sort of thing. And if they make some money, it's probably just.
It's to get you to quit Twitter, basically, so people can't send you stuff anymore.
Yeah.
What a weird... Like, do you think they ever update this so you can decorate your house? That seems like a...
It's kind of a big component of Tamodachi Life, so you'd think...
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's where they turn the screw a little bit and see how much money they can get out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like that seems like a smart place to start putting stuff on it, but you spend so little. I mean, you basically, your house is a prison, so you never leave it.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
but it's, but you also have no agency there. People just bust into your house to tell you about what they did today, and eventually you just tell them, like, okay, you need to leave, you need to go. You worked this today, good, please leave. I want to play with my hi-fi stereo sitting over here. Can you leave now?
Now, of course, hey, I just found out where Serin is from. So, you know, this is going to be good. A place where suffering is eternal and cheese is delicious. Wisconsin. That's where she's from. So I'm going to like that one.
Great.
And I'm not going to comment on it. You
could always say...
We getting a play-by-play of you playing me?
I just got something from Guillaume.
You could always say the suffering will be somewhat less by Tuesday, after Tuesday.
All right, so this is what Guillaume says to me.
Did we just turn this into an audio Let's Play? What is happening right now?
Something hilarious happened to Guillaume recently. He said, some guy called my home asking if I was the same Guillaume V featured in a sexy fireman. Oh, this, you told this story on Twitter. Calendar.
I did.
And if he could move in with me. So this is real life.
What?
This is real life drama.
Wait, hold on.
This is the kind of stuff that you're missing out on, Greg, by not being on Twitter.
Well, I'll just get John to relay it to me in audio form. It's fine.
Welcome.
Yes.
Because there's not that many people who... Not that many Guillaume Bayettes in the phone book, apparently. And apparently one of them is really sexy. So
he sure is. Anyway, I think we need to stop this segment.
That's
yes.
Because I'm scared mostly, and it's we're gonna head out, and when we come back, God help us, it's time for listener mail. Now playing a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have the NWR book interview with Justin Nation. Our deposed dictator, Johnny Metz, sits down with Justin Nation, one of the founding fathers of what is now Nintendo World Report. If you want to blame John Lindemann on anybody, the blood is on his hands. This is actually on the RFN RSS feed if you didn't download it earlier. You can just go back to the episode before this and grab it. Johnny's long-running quest of what is now, 2 months? Long-running quest to do interviews, to write a book about the website.
Yes.
That he left us for that. He left us for his book.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. We're not bitter. We're not bitter.
Nope.
I mean, actually, we're not bitter because we got Greg. But that's fine. I'm just going to push everybody under the bus in this segment. Just everybody get right under that wheel and start this thing up. Let's go. Woo! Then again, he's already heard the last segment. And all that did was probably spared him the opportunity to be in your Miitomo. So, in the end, he probably made the right call.
Probably.
Also this week, before I keep digging that hole, we have a review revisit. Pokken Tournament on Wii U by Don Koopman. Don is now officially a video game connoisseur. Only the best games will satisfy his tender palate. So Pokken Tournament has passed the test. Watch as he reveals in the tastes and textures of the various Pokemon on display as he reviews this full course meal. I had to kind of trade into a sumptuous voice for that second.
Yeah.
Gotta ease into it.
All right, and we have a review revisit, another one, of Super Mario World by the staff. Ever wonder what the new kids think of Super Mario World? We asked them, and they responded with 5 capsule reviews of the game that makes a mockery of the amateur hour that is Super Mario Bros. 3. Brian, Danny, Casey, Alex, and John all bow down to the true king of Mario games and pledge their fealty.
So two things. One, you can tell the games really aren't coming out because we re-reviewed 2 games, one of which only came out like a month ago.
Yeah.
And two, John, you know, they're playing on the new 3DS. How do you feel about that 3DS D-pad Mario action?
I mean, it's pretty good on the new 3DS, right?
I don't have one.
I mean, I think it is. I mean, from everything I've heard.
Oh, okay. Well, but, well, yeah. Then maybe you can get back into Super Mario Bros. 3.
No. All right. We also have a feature, 5 things to do with your Animal Crossing Amiibo collection by Carmine Red.
Uh-oh. Oh, I don't like this is going.
Carmine has lots of Amiibo cards. They're only used by a handful of games, so what to do with them otherwise? He has some ideas. I don't want to post spoilers, but they involve goat cheese, a variant on the card game War, and naming children. Don't say I didn't warn you.
You can name our children right now, any day of the week. Any time of day at NintendoWorldReport.com. We're back. It's listener mail. You can send us your listener mail to RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com. I'm shocked if you've made it this far, because after the last segment, you've probably all just deleted, I'm going to say, everything from the device you're using to listen to this. You just formatted it back to being just raw metal and silicon.
That's the thing. They're probably busy sending me friend requests on...
It is at times like this that I'm reminded of the sort of old axiom that every episode is someone's first episode and a bit of me dies inside.
They're not all like this. God. They're just mostly like this.
Aren't they?
Sometimes at least one of us is absent and it gets better.
Yeah.
But then sometimes we bring in someone else and it gets worse.
Oh, don't blame it on outsiders. We can sabotage this show.
It's pretty much so. In other words, when I leave.
103, Guillaume. Outsiders are your biggest threat.
When I leave, it gets better.
Build a wall and make them pay for it. Anyway. I will make RFN great again right now with the email. Because this is our best chance at making this show sustainable. And right off the bat, Knucking Futz writes, God damn it. There's no saving this, is there?
No.
Hey, RFN crew. I did choose it. I didn't realize I was going to need to have a somber email with a reserved title and a nice name at the start. Instead, I get Knucking Futz writes. Hey, RFN crew, what is your predictions for how long the Wii U and 3DS family of handhelds, did Nintendo write this, will be supported upon the NX's unveiling and release in the West? Also, in reference to the possible portable unit of the NX, what are the chances that 3DS/DS cartridges would be supported? Keep up the great content, guys. When we start some, you can send us this email again, but John's probably trying to queue up some Miitomo answers to this, so I'm going to try to get in here first to give him a chance to get it in there. So, does anybody think there will be a Wii U game at E3
2017?
No.
I don't.
I mean, obviously,
this
email was sent before the Nikkei report about them halting Wii U production by the end of this calendar year.
Right.
You know, so we've had that report, you know, which is fairly credible.
And the denial.
So, you know, I feel like that gives you, and I mean, you only have to look at the most recent
direct as well. It just felt like, even though 3DS is the one that's really getting long in the tooth, there was more meat on those bones for the rest of the year, especially when you got something as big as Pokemon at the end of it. Whereas,
right,
you know, Wii U, obviously, you know, Paper Mario, Star Fox, I mean, there's games that are, you know, interesting or, you know, worth kind of considering. Obviously, the Zelda situation, but we all know, you know, where that could go. But yeah, I really do feel like Wii U is, you know, it, obviously, as we've mentioned, it's not been any kind of commercial success, really. You know, which doesn't really, you know, speak to the quality of the games on it, but that's the way it is. It's turned out. It's just, you know, it's not sold as well as the GameCube did, even. And, yeah, I think they're going to look to move on pretty rapidly. Yeah, I don't think there'll be much dithering about that. 3DS, is a bit of a tougher question to answer because, you know, it remains, you know, such a sort of, leading platform in Japan, the home market, and we talk about how Japan-centric Nintendo is. And of course, the other component to this question is the old chestnut about what the NX is, which we don't know. You know, it's
right,
kind of difficult to say exactly how quickly they would move to kill certain things off without knowing exactly how much it is or isn't replacing them, kind of one for one.
Yeah, right. It's going to be difficult to say, especially the DS and 3DS, because there's such a strange, like, screen dimension to those games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, again, I guess the idea of, you know, just looking Futz's own use of the nomenclature, you know, family of systems, or if there is an NX family of systems, maybe there could be a unit that would read those cards and, you know, support those backwards compatibility. I don't know. I'm not sure it would be a standard feature.
Yeah.
But just the mechanics of you have to have a touch screen. It's got to have two screens or some way to layer the crazy format of the 3DS of one screen bigger than the other. There's a lot that has to happen to make this thing work.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be this desire to just go like, oh God, no, we can't do this again. We can't do this again. Let's get out.
Now, I mean, I could see them. I think Wii U is going to be dropped like a bad habit, but the one thing I will say about 3DS is the fact that they did just release new 3DS hardware means that they may be expecting it to live a little bit longer. So backwards compatibility, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure if the new 3DS sold enough to warrant that, though. Like,
I feel like that was more aimed at ginning up current sales to make up for shortfalls in their kind of revenue projections. You know, when they set targets that they share with the shareholders, you know, and they're not falling, they're not hitting them. That was their way of trying to give it a shot in the arm. You know, so I'm not sure if it was really aimed at extending its life, but it may also depend on, you know, not just what the NX is, but how well it does. You know, I mean, if we go back to the old third pillar, you know, construction with the DS, you know, had the DS sort of just flailed about and not really made much of an impact, you know, the GBA's killing off would have happened very differently, if at all, you know? So there's that to consider.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that whatever comes out, like whatever support for the Wii U and 3DS that we see in the future, it's going to be projects that have been started a while ago and that just have taken time to finish and that are, for whatever reason, not easily ported to the NX. But also, you know, the 3DS, even though it's gotten more support than the Wii U, it's gotten almost no support from North America outside of indies. So, whatever games are coming out for it still in the future are going to come from Japan, and I could see perhaps some unreleased Japanese games being announced, like localization for these games being announced at future E3s. You know, kind of like Rhythm Heaven has been announced recently.
It's kind of surprising. Again, if you go back to, you know, that period I was talking about, with the SGBA kind of overlap period, you know, GBA games did continue to come out of Japan a lot into the DS's life. But of course, you know, the Nintendo of America strategy at that time was basically like, let's just kill off the GBA. So Mother 3 was a casualty of that. The original Rhythm Heaven was a casualty of that. Meanwhile, you know, stuff like the Final Fantasy remakes, you know, 4, 5, and 6 were still coming out up until like 2007 or whatever, you know. So, yeah, that could be the thing. Maybe that those third-party games could keep being supported from the Japanese publishers for a bit longer out. But
yeah,
I mean,
at the very least, it's not as cost prohibitive to make any new games for the 3DS as opposed to the Wii U. I mean, the Wii U, aside from the fact that the market is dead for it, it's just costly to make Wii U games. I mean, and it's not cheap to make 3DS games, but, you know, at least it has that on its side.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering about indies about with the Wii U because they... You know, just because they're indie doesn't mean that they're like short projects that are done quick. Like a lot of the indie demos that were showcased last E3, like three of them still haven't been released. Like one of them came out today, Lovely Planet, but there's three more that still don't have a release date as far as I know. So I'm guessing we could still see some you know, late indie support. And there's even, like, didn't they announce Super Meat Boy for the Wii U?
Yeah, they did at the last. It was in the reel sort of indie game, so that was contained within the last direct. Yeah, I said Pinball Arcade, the Pixel Jump Monsters. That's it. Stuff like Blast from the Past that came along there. It seems like it's a bit late for that, but I won't say no. Of course, Axiom Verge as well is not something that's a Blast from the Past, but that is coming to Wii U. Mm-hmm. You know, so maybe you get more of that type of thing, you know, something that's a temporary exclusive on PS4 or Xbox One that could come over, you know, after that time's been seen out. But yeah, I think Nintendo is really gonna throttle the Wii U quickly, and that will lessen its attractiveness to everyone, because, you know, that's really kind of the attractiveness for indies, is that, you know, this is where Nintendo fans play their games. We have a product that we think dovetails with that kind of, you know, taste in game, so we put it there. If Nintendo, you know, cuts off the pipeline to Wii U, everyone assumes that the Nintendo fans have kind of moved away from it too, then, you know, that effect kind of trickles down the line.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I expect that there is maybe one to two games on Wii U that we don't know about, and that's probably it. Like, that, you think about it in that term, that's kind of a bummer. I think they'll do the something gets announced, you know, at E3, and we go, oh, okay, that's nice. But that's it. And it's probably not something that we're going to be super excited about.
Yeah, and whether it even ends up coming out on Wii U would still be a question, again, to reference a previous cycle. I mean, you look at some of the GameCube games that were sort of teased back in 2005, I guess, you know, 2006. You know, stuff like Paper Mario, Super Paper Mario, excuse me, and the DK Barrel Blast thing that was meant to be the Bongo Racing game and all that, you know. They were shown as GameCube games, but, you know, obviously they ended up being Wii games because GameCube just was similarly kind of running out of gas pretty hard. And, of course, they were very easy to port. Systems were fundamentally the same. That, again, goes to the fact that we don't know exactly what NX is going to be, so we don't know how easy porting would be or whatever else. That's a separate question.
Right. But, yeah, to the point, I think 3DS does still have some steam there that we could get out, and that's probably fine for a while, just to get some stuff out there. I think Pokemon Sun and Moon is not the last train into the station on the 3DS. I think as long as that, the promise of that keeps stuff there, people will continue to put stuff on that system, even if it's just other Japanese publishers.
Yeah,
after
it just seems like Pokemon is kind of, when they release a Pokemon game late, that usually means that the handheld's going to stick around for a little while.
Yeah, so, I mean, they've stuck around late before, obviously, with the transition from DS to 3DS, but I mean, it's just one of those sort of series that tends to do that. I mean, another one would be Dragon Quest XI is coming, you know, and that is going to be huge. Obviously, there's more than one version of that. We may well think Subversion is going to show up on NX, etc., but we know there's going to be, you know, there is a 3DS version, and we know that's going to do very well in Japan. And again, that presumably keeps that. The fact that it's got this sort of real mainstream solid user base in Japan means that, you know, you are going to have some kind of stream of content for that going beyond the end of this year.
Yeah. And you know, I'm trying to think of what would be a company like Atlus, actually, is a good example. They'll put out some more stuff on the 3DS.
And you got the localization lag as well for us, you know, like Etrian Odyssey 5 is coming this year in Japan, but obviously, you know, we're not going to get that straight away, especially in Europe. It probably would be 2017 by the time Europe gets it, but that kind of stuff as well, that localization lag, provided that, you know, as we assume in most of this content is coming out of Japan, is going to kind of artificially kind of extend the range of 3DS software a little bit.
Right, although maybe I wouldn't count on Etrian Odyssey to have a long localization time, because I think Untold came out 4 months after the Japanese release.
They've got it relatively tight in America now. Like I said, with Europe it'd be a bit longer, but still 4 months is, you know, it's a third of a year. It's we're at this point where things may change very rapidly with the NX coming along. So we'll see how long that sort of feels in the life of the system, such as what it's got left.
Well, and the one thing I was going to point out is now that they announced today actually that Sega is publishing Atlus's games, but Atlus is going to keep doing. They've started picking up some games that Sega had put out on 3DS that didn't get released here. They've done two
Seventh
now.
Seventh Dragon was kind
of the most recent one. Yeah,
that was a shock. That was a shock, though, wasn't it?
VFD, like that. I'm still shocked. So they could probably go back to that well a little bit, pump some stuff out there, get some late system sales, and just, you know, because there is kind of this weird calm when the successor system comes out and people haven't converted yet. Of, well, I can put out stuff and maybe people will buy it because they don't have the new system where the things are coming out now. Sort of like Yakuza 5-ish stuff on the PS3, where it's just like Sega's like, well, we can put this out because nobody else is putting things out on this system.
Yeah,
and it did okay. There was a niche desire for it, and there it was. But yeah, I mean, we might see some stuff for this for next E3 for 3DS and Wii U. The one after that, maybe 3DS, but if we use there, it's only going to be there because an indie developer is putting out their game on multiple systems and Wii U is one of the target platforms.
Yeah, and I mean, it will not be the focus of any of their presentations or anything like that or anything.
Right.
No.
Like,
anyway,
you know, a reel at the end, maybe, but
I think they need to be done with it.
I would say so.
But again, we don't know what the NX is. Anyway, Greg.
So Renee writes, DS has sold well over 100 million units. Why do older generation consoles that are very successful stop being supported? That seems like such a huge potential audience that's being ignored. If they were to repurpose assets, much like Bravely Second End Layer does, and make Radiant Historia 2 or Phantom Hourglass 2, didn't they already do that? Wouldn't that appeal? And sell to some percentage of DS owners. Even if just 1% of us purchased Phantom Hourglass 2, that would instantly make it a million seller. I've always felt that the DS Lite was the perfect system for RPGs and those classic SNES type games like Castlevania. It's portable, has long battery life, and for those of us who love the 16-bit era, it delivers that style flawlessly. It's a modern SNES, it's a really nice little console. I would happily play Radiant Historia 2 on my DS in the year 2016. The Wii was always a little underpowered and non-HD, but I think the DS is different. It does what it does well. It's adequately powered to deliver the experience it intends. Anyway, maybe I'm alone, but I would buy new DS games today if they were sequels to some of the games I loved 10 years ago.
It's kind of funny, the timing of this letter, when news came out today that the DSiWare shop this closing next year.
It's almost like I planned this 1-2 punch of emails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's well.
It's
yeah.
funny how fate conspires to bring us this email now. Yes.
Yeah, I mean,
Soul Calibur too.
The first thing you've got, the first thing you've got to mention here is competition. Is a big factor in all this. Certainly, many times, you know, I mean, I think in many ways, you know, if you go back to the Famicom NES cycle, which lasted, you know, quite a long time. You know, Nintendo probably would have been happy to sit on that a little bit longer, to be honest, such was the dominance of their position. But you had the threat of competition and the reality of competition from, you know, the TG16 coming out in Japan, PC Engine, you know, the Mega Drive Genesis, all that kind of stuff. And if they had just left the Famicom in place and just kept turning out games for that, then those systems would, you know, gradually have mopped up more and more developer support, more and more people looking to buy something new, and Nintendo would have kind of had a trouble, you know, may have faded into some sort of obsolescence or whatever. So then, you know, they bring forth the Super Famicom, the Super NES, and so it's gone from there. You know, if you look at the, you know, the PlayStation and the Saturn coming in before N64 came out and so forth. So a lot of it is just, you know, the fact that, you know, while you might like to do that and, you know, keep selling cheap hardware at a profit and all this kind of stuff, you know, there's a feeling that, you know, you're going to lose your audience to newer, shiny things. And the fact is, these days, I guess, it's not even so much the threat of other sort of games platforms, in terms of like dedicated hardware, you know, Sony coming in and, you know, making another Vita or whatever is not really that much of a concern anymore, is it? You know, I think they're done with that. But now it's competition from, you know, everything else, isn't it? And Nintendo have talked about competing with everything else before. And it really is, you know, everything else is really starting to eat their lunch now, you know, with mobile and all that kind of stuff. So you're really under pressure to revamp, revitalize, you know, platforms so they can actually help you kind of hold the attention of the audience that exists today. While, you know, it might be the case that Renee would happily play DS games and I would happily play DS games, are there enough of those people to actually, you know, make that a viable strategy? No. You know, especially in the past, Nintendo have liked to sell hardware at a profit. Which they haven't been doing such a good job of lately.
No.
You know, that makes them even more, you know, apt to be eager to sell you new hardware. It really is just the competition for people's attention, you know, their time at this point, I feel, that demands refreshing the platform so that it may meet their standards, you know, relative to the market as it is today.
Yeah, I mean, eventually there comes a certain point where your competitors can use your outdated tech against you as, you know, as argument for, oh, why would you play with the Nintendo DS? It's so outdated.
And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. You can go back to like the Game Gear but that was a situation where your tech had to be on point. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, it's six about batteries. What, about what actually mattered with that, wasn't it?
You know, six batteries that die over in minutes is not on point, but. That's kind of what the DS was, though. The DS was like this, like, oh shit, there's this thing coming, we need to react to it.
Yeah.
Ultimately. Yeah. I mean, it was.
No,
that's
a great, exactly. I mean, like, you know, did the GBA have to die, you know, when it did? Not at all.
No,
I mean,
it didn't, because they couldn't kill it, was the problem.
It was very hasty. You know, they had a number of games in development for it that ended up maybe just coming out in Japan or getting, you know, shunted over to DS, or, you know, in the case of Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, they had a version for both DS and GBA, you know. But no, exactly. But why did they do it? Because of competition, because PSP was coming on the horizon. That was very worrying, and that's why they made the decision they did. Like I said, now that dynamic is different. I grant you that, you know, when they did the move up to 3DS, how much of that was, yeah, because they were really worried about, you know, Sony coming up with a new device. I don't think it was. I think they felt like, you know, the appeal of the DS sales were tailing off, especially in terms of software. And so they needed a way of, you know, kind of revitalizing their market, a way of justifying, charging more money for their box games as well. You know, they feel like maybe if it's going to be a smaller market that's going to be buying the games now, you know, you need to get more out of them, but you also need, you know, to put more in terms of, you know, higher quality graphics. The stereoscopic 3D was meant to be a selling point, all that kind of stuff. That's what they were looking to do when they, you know, moved on from DS to 3DS with, you know, mixed success, to say the least, at first.
So do we think, because I think that's what I kept hearing towards the end of the DS life, but do we think that piracy was a big motivator to bring out the 3DS and to kind of kill the DS? Because that seemed to be the go-to excuse for I don't remember where I read it. For Nintendo, did Nintendo come out and say that there was just too much piracy? Or was it smaller developers?
Nintendo spoke about how developers were, or publishers were impressed by how difficult it would be to pirate on 3DS. Because the flashcards have become just notorious on DS.
The awful situation, and all that.
I'm seeing on the Wikipedia article that 100,000 copying devices, including R4s, were seized in the UK in 2009.
So that's one year
in one country.
And keep in mind, that's not exactly a huge country either. Like, it's 100 in the UK, not in the world, in one country.
It was rampant, and I feel like they would have seen that as a, you know, as a big, at the very least, a very sort of nice opportunity to, you know, to move on to a more difficult to pirate format. I have the feeling they probably overestimated how much, you know, revenue they would claw back from that.
I'm sure in a lot of ways it actually served to dictate the design of the 3DS, because, hey, why not? What better way to combat piracy than to create an experience via hardware that you literally can't get if you try it on some sort of emulated thing? Yeah. Well, unless you use an R4 cartridge, but...
Right. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that refreshing to a new, when you do a whole new platform launch, you can do new stuff. I know that sounds vague, but I'll give you the example. The DSi, because it was technically its own system, it had a shop that, as we talked about, is going away. But only a small fraction of DS owners had DSis. You had to make the conscious decision to upgrade to a system that arguably lost features. It couldn't play GBA games anymore.
But
with the 3DS, everybody now had access to a shop. And if you wanted to play any new games, you had to upgrade. And that could get Nintendo your money digitally, which means they get a much bigger cut of it for less put out on their part.
And also, there's the fact that, again, in the kind of keeping up with competition lines, you know, people were getting used to buying games and all sorts of things digitally.
Right.
So you got to move with the times on that, you know, otherwise, you know, I said, if you just stuck with the original DS Lite construction for in perpetuity, you know, how are you going to cash in on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say that the ultimate answer to walk away with this from is there's a lot of reasons why systems end up going. What I do think, though, speaking specifically to what Renee is mentioning here, is that we've seen some of it on 3DS. We saw it with, Triforce Heroes. We saw basically a game that said, we're going to reuse the assets from Link Between Worlds and make a whole different kind of experience out of them.
Yep.
And we still get that stuff. Like he mentioned one on the DS. He said Phantom Hourglass. I mean, we had that game. It was
Spirit Tracks.
I mean, it didn't reuse a lot of assets, but it reused some, obviously.
Well, and just the fundamentals of the game as well, the controls that they created, the aesthetic, all those sorts of things. So, yeah, I mean, of course, these are the things you get like late in cycles, and I guess it could keep going longer, and it depends on the specific circumstances. But as I say, I mean, it's just a question of really, like, you have to keep up with the market to some extent, and it's not just as narrow as, well, you know, there's a PSP coming or something like that. Obviously, if you have something like that in the past,
there's a lot of factors.
That was a big expedite thing. But yeah, it could be piracy. It could be moving into digital. There's a lot of different ways in which you just have to kind of move up with the times. And the other thing is at that point, you have to then say, well, if we're going to make this new platform work, we have to, you know, give it as full support. We have to make sure that people realize that, you know, yeah, we're putting our best teams on this. We're putting out, you know, some of our games that are going to be bigger and better than ever and all that kind of stuff. So that's where, you know, the other system really gets throttled, you know, is that, you know, all the resources get diverted away. And in some cases, like with, you know, with NOA during that GBADS phase, even just games that are finished, they're just like, kill it. You could look at Star Fox 2 on Super Nintendo. You know, that was a game that was done essentially, and they decided to kill it. It was like, well, this is a kind of experience that we want to emphasize on N64, that somehow it's unique to N64, you know, that we could do it on N64 better with the analog controller and all that, so we're just going to kill it on Super Nintendo to sort of emphasize the step change that's being made in, you know, sort of 3D gameplay on that format, you know. So these are just, unfortunately, it might seem kind of sad that, you know, not only do you kind of move on to another platform, but sometimes you're going to actively throttle the old one when we've had such good times with it, but that's business.
Well, actually, to speak on that a little bit about situations where the counterexample happened, where a market player attempted to support both systems. John, the Sega Neptune. Do you know what the Sega Neptune was?
The Sega Neptune, wasn't that a handheld of the Genesis?
No. That's the Nomad. It was a Genesis combined with a 32X that was gonna run parallel to the Saturn market. Because the 32X came out to be like, our 16-bit system can still go, and we can still make games for that, and make games for this Saturn thing at the same time, and make games for the Game Gear. And they just split, I mean, A,
The upshot of it is that Sega did a very bad job of capitalizing on the, you know, success, the foothold that it got in the North American market, you know, especially, and Europe as well, you know, translating that to the next system. They muddied the waters so much with 32X, and then they were thinking
Sega
about that.
CD.
Yeah, yep. Sega CD, all that, that I don't think there was enough of a sort of recognition of Saturn being, you know, this step change that you know, was going to get all the, you know, the biggest, best games from Sega, you know, and they were just going to totally move on from the Genesis of the Mega Drive in the different regions. So, yeah,
I think
it's a good point.
And trying to maintain that, they made architectural decisions on, like, the Saturn that were boneheaded. Just.
Oh, is this involved totally, the quadrilateral thing? Is this what?
Yeah, like, it just lacked any kind of foresight into where things were going ultimately. So they ended up with this kind of mentality that developed a system that wasn't ready for the real world. And their answer for that, and ultimately, thank God it didn't happen, was at one point they were designing an add-on for the Saturn that would give it the ability to play, to be more competitive in the space that it had tried to evolve it into, which sounds like the most insane move that they could have ever possibly made of, we screwed up by making add-ons.
Let's make more add-ons. Yeah. So, because if I remember correctly, the Saturn was really, really terrible at doing 3D games, right? Like,
it struggled mightily. Because ultimately, they built it in the 32X, had things in common. Like not in a lot of ways, but like, there were things, like, there was a mentality of there that was not, you know, completely different. Like, there was some thought process.
I don't think it was enough of a clean break, given, you know, the feeling that the industry was on the cusp of the 3D era beginning, you know, at that kind of consumer level. But also, I mean, they made loads of stupid mistakes in that. I mean, they couldn't get.
Yeah, oh yeah, they were.
They couldn't get Sonic, you know, in a real true headline successor type game on that system. I mean, how could you miss that? I mean, it's just ridiculous.
I mean, when we say they made a lot of mistakes, 32X was a product driven by fear of the Atari Jaguar. Like mistakes yeah. were made. Mistakes were made everywhere. But it drives to the point. At that point, they had the Game Gear, which was a Master System. They had the Genesis itself. They had the Sega CD. They had the 32X, which was this kind of 3D hybrid Genesis thing. They had the Saturn, which was this 2D, 3D hybrid console that they're making. And they just spread themselves too thin. And they couldn't, to your point, they couldn't get a mainline Sonic game in part because they had gone and made Sonic CD to sell the Sega CD. Like there's only so much Sonic Team could produce for them. They just didn't give... They didn't give their resources the places they needed to be. Like
In that case, a clean break, or certainly a much cleaner one, would have served them much better for capitalizing on the momentum they had in Western yeah. markets at that time.
Yeah, it
so
was.
So the reverse is, well, this is, you know, people, you know, companies have been better served doing it that way. You know, when they have done. I mean, I guess you can have successful low key stuff. Like you think of some really late NES games like Kirby's sure. Adventure mm-hmm. and things like that came out in 93, I think, you know, a long, long time after. Gargoyle's Quest was in 92. Gargoyle's Quest 2, excuse me, was in 92 and things like that. You know, so when it's kind of low key like that, you know, you can have some successes along there, but never is it going to be the same as, you know, I don't think it'd ever be to the extent that what Renee's looking for in that question, you know?
Right.
And it's just, I know he talks about the size of the user base, but in terms of an effective user base, you know, it shrunk yeah. so much at that point. And that's a lot of the reason why they moved on from the DS specifically. I mean, you talk about the piracy stuff, which kind of effectively yep. shrunk the user base in terms of how many people would actually pay to buy games. But, you know, also just people have moved on to other things. You know, the
iPhone primarily, that carved into their overall target audience. Huge. Like, sure. I think it pretty much took about 2/3 of the audience away. Like that 100 million that bought the DS. Yeah, about 60 of that went to, you know, Android and iPhone, pretty much.
Well, yeah, I mean, those DSs just weren't in circulation at that point. Like, they existed, yep. but they were sitting in on a shelf somewhere.
Yep. They're inert. Their half-life right. has expired.
yep.
Yes. But, yeah, I mean, it is a bummer because there's always the concern when you move platforms that you're ratcheting up the cost of development again. You know, making a game like Radiant Historia, you couldn't really release Radiant Historia on the 3DS as a full retail game because it's visually just not acceptable as par for that platform. But
you think of like Overclocked, yeah, the 2.0, the Devil, was it SMT spin off is it again? Devil Survivor,
but it's a DS port. Like it's marketed as a DS port.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying, like, you can't. It's borderline, but yeah, I know what you're saying.
And even then, that had to be early in the system. Like,
yes, granted,
they did the sequel later because Atlas has lost their goddamn minds. But
they did, yeah, Record Break or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, it's there's always the concern that you lose the ability to make some of the games that the previous system supported just because it's absolutely. More expensive to make that game.
And a lot of the time that's got nothing to do with creative stuff. You know, it's things that, you know, like what we talked about with these different systems, they're better at doing some things than others. You know, why did Nintendo's rich tradition of making 2D games get, you know, shaved down to the barest level with N64? Is because of how they built the hardware. You know,
it actively kind of sucks at 2D games.
I mean, yes, you had some, you know, things out there, you know, like Yoshi's Story, and then, you know, Kirby 64 was essentially 2D, but there's polygonal graphics. But, you know, that changed the whole, you know, I mean, yes, all right, yeah, of course you want Mario 64, you know, the stuff that pushed the boundaries and all that kind of stuff, but I mean, it did come at a cost, you know, like Nintendo didn't really fully discover their kind of 2D verve, arguably, until like the GBA era, because Game Boy platforms remained so kind of limited until then. You know, and they didn't necessarily dedicate that much resources to those until Pokemon unexpectedly revitalized the platform.
The Game Boy was very much stuck in the NES era until then, and then they tried to like force it into the Super Nintendo era. But ultimately, it wasn't until the GBA came out where they actually could do that organically. And
yeah,
you had that first wave of GBA titles where you said, oh, we're back here now. And you saw like that Rayman port for the GBA. And you thought, oh, okay. Okay, we're back to like kind of modern games now.
Now, my question is, could somebody right now make a DS game? Because that would be gated by Nintendo.
Would Nintendo let you?
They're the ones that actually make the cartridges, correct?
I don't know that they would let you at this point.
Yeah. See, because but it's not like, because I know that they're, like, for example, I believe it was Dreamcast that just had a game released for it a couple years ago after being dead.
Oh, yeah, you still get those kind of like, shooters like that come out for Dreamcast.
But I think because of the cartridge format, I don't believe that that's possible with something like the DS.
Yeah, I mean, there may just not be, you know, cartridge blanks in circulation.
Yeah.
But that's a good question, because ultimately, if you have a proprietary media format, which technically speaking, all of the platform holders do, because I don't think you can go make your own, I know for a fact you can't go make your own Xbox One games, because that was the reason that we didn't get a retail release of Shovel Knight on Xbox One, because they couldn't get a low enough run from Microsoft. So. Yep. Effectively, a platform holder can just freeze you out. So even if Atlus wanted to have made Etrian Odyssey 2 in, say, 2012, or Capcom, please, wanted to make Ghost Trick 2, Nintendo may have just said, no, you can't. Like, just, no. Go away. Make it for 3DS.
Well, and they'd always be very eager to, you know, graduate their sort of third-party publisher partners onto the next platform. And, you know, sometimes I think they feel like a platform change is a good chance to sort of revitalize some of those relationships. I mean, DS was really successful, but there was a feeling between the piracy and the way the market went in the West, where it got flooded with a lot of kind of, you know, shovelware-y type stuff and all that, that 3DS would be a chance for third parties to come back in, especially in West. There was a lot of early interest, wasn't there? It was like, oh, you know, we're going to have this game, that game, you know, all these, was it Saints Row and Contra?
DJ
and all
Hero. DJ Hero?
All this stuff was offered initially. And of course, you know, with the 3DS rough start, that went away fast. But, you know, it's indicative of the potential that you can see for a refresh to, you know, maybe bring new possibilities for, you know, getting different kind of third-party support that might help sell your platform. And Nintendo's going to be in sore need of that kind of refresh with the NX.
Anyway, I think we should move on. So, Guillaume.
Nick writes, hey guys, as a lifelong Nintendo loyalist, I have spent a lot of money on Nintendo products. I honestly enjoy doing so because I know I'm funding a company I want to enjoy for the rest of my life. The problem I encounter sometimes is feeling like Nintendo doesn't want my money that badly. The most recent example in my life has to do with their catalog of music and sound effects. I recently decided that I want the aesthetic theme from Super Mario World as my ringtone. It struck me that there is no official channel for doing this. In fact, there's nowhere I can even buy the song, just for my listening pleasure. As a person who has purchased game soundtracks before, I feel like this is a missed opportunity, especially considering recordings that must have been made at events such as the Symphony of the Goddess shows. Plus, their back catalog of these items holds immense nostalgic value now. I think piracy and the number of knockoffs and covers on stores like iTunes show that there is a demand. Do you think there is enough money-making potential in offering their music and sounds for purchase that Nintendo should pursue it? And as the company looks to diversify into mobile and beyond, do you think they are likely to consider this? Will I ever get my ringtone or be able to listen to the Link to the Past Dark World theme whenever I want? Thanks. P.S. I'm not above piracy, but I prefer to pay the content owners.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if they started putting out ringtones and stuff like that. I don't know why they haven't done that yet.
So let me ask, do people still put out like ringtone versions of of songs, or they just put out the song and say, make it your ringtone yourself, your phone can handle it.
Yeah, I don't know. But it would be nice to just be able to just do it. Just
but yeah,
they did. One of the rewards on the that was still on the European Club Nintendo as it was sort of shambling towards its end was ringtones of some sort. So I never did redeem any of my points towards those. But that's generally what they've done. You know, some music, a lot of soundtracks were in that Club Nintendo catalog as well. I got quite a few of them. Super Mario 3D World, Link Between Worlds, Kirby Triple Deluxe. Yeah, those were the physical rewards I always wanted the most, even though I didn't need them. I just kind of liked having the packaging of the CD there. You know, as a collector more than anything else.
You just have to rub the salt in the wound, don't you, Greg?
I mean,
we mostly didn't get those, and it kind of surprises me, you know, like the way that Nintendo of America embraced digital downloads of their games as reward, Club Nintendo rewards, but they wouldn't just give us MP3s.
Like, yeah, they did that with they did do that with Xenoblade. I think, didn't they? Over here, the original Xenoblade on Wii, there was like it just gave you a download of the soundtrack.
But even that got messed up with the sequel with X coming with a USB key with the special edition, and it had tons of DRM, and apparently it was just a nightmare to get the MP3s off that USB stick. So
no, it's interesting the way they treat it. I have a feeling, you know, kind of like Jot, that, you know, the way they're moving with being more open about licensing and all this kind of stuff, the idea that they can make their characters and properties kind of work harder for them outside of games, that this is some sort of area that they might look at. But in terms of the real kind of market potential of it, I'm not that sure, you know, if it's a huge like money spinner or whatever. But I mean, just having some of this stuff out there is probably decent just for awareness and recognition, you know, that kind of thing. Just you know, having them be, you know, some of these classic songs and things that people can identify with Nintendo, kind of perpetuating that out there, is, you know, has a some sort of external benefit to it as well. As
I mean, they did just try to trademark the coin sound in Japan.
Yeah, they did.
Which I thought was interesting. I mean, I could see that being used for ringtones or something, or maybe part of a larger, I don't know, monetization of some sort.
Hmm. There is some, and I'm not going to get too deep into music law, but specifically on the topic of music, there is some very odd stuff around licensing. When you start selling music as a musical product, as it's saying, I am selling this as music versus this music is a part of the game, for example. And you get into some stuff. I want to say the term is like compulsory licensing, which is primarily in the context of, I want to use this piece of music, this trademarked or copyrighted piece of music in a, you know, fair use sort of commercial way, and I can essentially use some established rate and pay the holder without getting their permission, and there's not really much they could do about it. Now, it doesn't allow you to essentially reuse it wholesale, but it may be that they don't want to deal with that shit. I know it's a pain in the ass to deal with. It would be kind of a weird thing for them to do, but I can understand at the same time them just saying, like, I don't want to mess with this. We know this is a legal minefield. Let's not deal with it. But I'm not
more,
an expert
more trouble
on this.
Than it's worth,
right. I'm not an expert on this topic, so I don't really feel comfortable getting into it. I just have kind of read around the margins over the years and seen this come up in the past. But ultimately, I think they probably will at some point make it easier to consume their music. And you have to keep in mind, in Japan, they're quite willing to put their music on literal ass albums that you can buy in the store in Japan. I was digging into this topic for a completely unrelated project a couple weeks ago, and I stumbled across the fact that there are, in fact, went to retail between 1998 and 2000, Legend of Zelda: The Ocarina of Time albums released in Japan under the auspices of Nintendo. One of them is just recordings of the game music, and one of them is this crazy remix thing that is completely bonkers insane.
It's a symphony one, isn't there?
There is, but that wasn't released in that window.
Okay.
That came later. These are like straight up Ocarina of Time soundtracks. And like you see that in Japan now with games, even modern things that had originally came up with games that didn't have, using a term a bit lazily, red book audio. Like it wasn't recording quality audio. It was digital music generated by sound chips. You would see this happen a lot. But even when we pivoted towards an MP3 era in Japan, there seemed to still be this appetite for retail albums of games. And I'm not going to claim to understand that particular foible of Japanese culture. Mm-hmm. But my guess is that if that market was there in that country, and yet Nintendo, and to a large extent, the video game industry as a whole, you don't see soundtracks coming out. You would think that there would still have been some market for this stuff, because they know that stuff's on YouTube and they aren't actively trying to pull it down in general. Which leads me to believe that there must be something beyond cultural that is a factor here when you consider the almost zero cost of digital sales of this music. There must be some legal dimension, and that's what leads me to wonder if that is where their reticence comes in. But again,
and why they seem to be just so keen to just give away music, like, you know, like,
right.
I mean, it's always some extra thing, you know, like the Symphony of the Goddess CD that came with Skyward Sword, you know, I mean, those shows have become quite expanded since then, haven't they? And even that, but that CD was not a full, it was not the length of a full concert, even as it existed in 2011. But today we have, you know, Majora's Mask pieces and, you know, things they've come up with later, you know, that you would kind of, you know, I would be interested in a full on, you know, double disc set, whatever it would take to have something more representative of the shows today. Cause I went to like basically like the first one, you know, before they sort of done some of this stuff, but you know, they don't seem terribly fussed about producing that. It's always these freebies is generally what we, well, they're not exactly free. There's an opportunity cost when you deal with, you know, expendable Nintendo points or whatever, but you know what I mean? They're not actually retail.
Go ahead, Gil.
No, sorry. I thought that I remembered some Nintendo soundtrack being released on iTunes recently, but I can't find it. I thought
there was a Pokemon one.
Pokemon.
But,
oh, okay.
But you're dealing with the Pokemon company there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right. That's the thing. They've got their own. They're all about licensing. That is their licensing operations. Yeah, they've got their own different sets,
but,
like thresholds for that.
If Nintendo is super serious about trying to use their IPs to leverage money, that's when maybe you bring in a third party who, if their concerns really are things like compulsory licensing, maybe that's when you bring in a company who just does this. But again, it's difficult to deal with this stuff because there are, you know, there, if you give, I'll give you a good example. If you give music away or the music is part of another production, It's protected, but if you sell the music on its whole, I believe anybody can do covers as long as they pay you a royalty, and you can't stop them. So there is that weird, like, I lose control thing. So maybe there's just no easy way forward for them, and maybe the answer is my Nintendo is how you're going to get it. They're going to give you rewards, and they're going to give you that music as a reward, and then it's protected, and they're all safe.
Yeah, I could see that. And I mean, it seems like my Nintendo's got in its sort of setup now the possibility to get a lot more kind of granular than Club Nintendo was, you know what I mean? Like, in terms of, you know, sort of go the kind of more micro rewards, you know, for maybe just like individual songs or that kind of stuff. I know they had ringtones before with the European Club Nintendo, as I mentioned, but it seems like this new setup is definitely, you know, especially with those platinum points where you accumulate in just a few of them for signing in every week or whatever. They can really sort of get down to low level stuff if they want.
Yeah. Oh, it does seem like a missed opportunity here, but I don't know. I'm now reading treaty law and compulsory mechanical licenses. So save me from this email, please, John.
Gladly. All right, Ash writes, "Hey guys, I hope you're well. With the latest virtual console releases on the new 3DS, I found myself in a dilemma. Do I buy one of my favorite games of all time, or do I take a punt on an indie game which is on sale?
I went on to the eShop to pick up Gunvolt, another one for the backlog, but the second I saw Super Mario World in person on the store, I wanted it for the 1,000,000th time. Thankfully, I managed to hold out and stuck to just getting Gunvolt, but apart from that, is hoping that at some point we'll have cross-buy, be it on the NX or via my Nintendo in a few weeks. Outrage if Nintendo reveals cross-buy this month, I guess then, though. If the VC games were available for free or with a side grade fee, I wouldn't have had a choice to make. If I was weaker, my money would have been spent double dipping and not supporting an indie and discovering new games. Just wondering if you had any views on this subject. As always, keep up the good work. One of my favorite 2 hours of the week.
Yeah, so we've touched on this a little bit with the new 3DS getting the Super Nintendo games, and they basically charge him full whack for that. And with my Nintendo going live, today, you can see, it charts all of your activity from months ago from the Nintendo ID, the double NID that's linked to it. So it knows that you've bought that particular game on what Wii U before or 3DS before, but they're just not doing cross-buy at this point. And I feel like it might be because they are looking more to the NX to start fresh with maybe a more integrated sort of, where if you've got multiple devices in the NX family, it's not one account tied to a particular piece of hardware. It truly is, you've got everything on there, and it's that, the licenses are portable across those systems and all that. I really hope that is the case anyway. I've run into a little bit of a problem with this because I got a 3DS XL when Link Between Worlds was coming out, because the original 3DS was not very nice, I wanted to upgrade. But then I started using my old 3DS sort of beat up old one just to kind of take around for Game Pass and stuff. Game Pass. That's what I pay for that's what I pay the NFL a lot of money to watch NFL games. I'm sorry. Street Pass. I take the old 3DS out to do Street Pass and stuff. And I kind of found that, I kind of like this idea of having the big XL at home and then the smaller one to take on the road and do Street Pass and stuff like that. But of course, they're not integrated yet, And so that is really irritating. That's something I certainly hope that the NX is going to fix big time. And it will make me more likely to build up a kind of fully robust library of games, in a virtual console kind of format, especially, those ones that I have bought before. Yeah, because with the ones I have bought before at this point, I'm always a little bit reticent. It has to be, I particularly want to play it right now in an easy and convenient way rather than going and getting the cartridge, or it would somehow benefit from being portable or off TV play that naturally it didn't have before or something like that. It's not just like, oh, hey, I love that game, I want to have it with me, whenever I feel like playing it again, I'll buy it again. I haven't got to that point yet because of these sorts of issues.
Yeah, the whole having a big desire to play a game right now thing, I didn't want to be an ass, but on Twitter I did ask. Like, I was kind of shocked that so many people, when the Super Mario World came out on new 3DS, that there was this pent-up kind of demand for the game to play it again, and I was just, how is this possible? Like, how many 2D Mario games have we got in the past few years? And Mario Maker just came out, and Super Mario World was released not that long ago on the Wii U. But I guess with the sales of the Wii U being what they are, I probably shouldn't assume that all of the people I follow on Twitter have a Wii U. So
I shouldn't assume they have a new 3DS either. But the point taken.
Right.
You should assume that even less.
Yeah, but it's kind of surprised me. But I guess if you haven't played it since it was released on the Wii Virtual Console, 7-8 years ago now? You could have this kind of, Super Mario World and portably on my 3DS. Yeah, give me that right now. But
Super Metroid.
Give me that right now, an RFN story.
Super Metroid and Super Metroid and Earthbound is the first time they've ever been portable, so I could kind of get that. More, you know, they really loved
right.
games.
If you didn't own a PSP, I guess.
Well,
yeah. Fair. Or a DS is a good flash cart, to be fair.
Yeah.
Right.
I would say that, so there's a couple things to unpack here. Nintendo has done cross-buy for games. Like, they can.
Yeah. Yeah, oh no, that's fact, what I'm saying. They've got the account information now to do it. They're just not doing it yet, which makes me feel like they're going to kind of go back to what we said about Star Fox 2 getting killed off. It's like, it's going to be a feature of NX that it will have this kind of cross-buy stuff as standard. Mm-hmm. Even when right. there's no reason why it couldn't be more so now.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of an artificial distinction that they're going to sort of build up, I think.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like they stay so behind the curve that by the time they actually roll something out, people are like, oh my God, this is like 5 years overdue. Thank you. So that's kind of the demo.
Yeah, what's interesting about the idea, I've never contemplated the idea that this potentially hurts indie games, though, that the fact that people can just buy or would just buy again and again the same game.
Well, wasn't that kind of the justification that Nintendo of America gave when they rolled that WiiWare and kind of killed off the Virtual Console? Like, they were like,
It would, like, one would cannibalize the other kind of thing. Yeah, there was some sort of line of thought there, wasn't there?
Right. Yeah, so...
Well, there was some PR speak, at least.
Yeah, probably, because probably the VC was dying off because it was getting more and more difficult to find the proper people to talk to for licenses.
Because Natsume's going, we've got 17 more Harvest Moon games you want to
Especially because they actually didn't have such a slow drip of content as they began with on Wii U. Yeah, they started faster. You know, they got to the deeper cuts. quicker, in America and Europe. So yeah, there is that.
Right.
I mean, for God's sake, we got Lords of Thunder pretty fast, all things considered. Like that should have been like that. Shoeniki should have been like games that come out when nobody has anything left.
What are you talking about, James?
It's bloody good. But Lords of Thunder is a bloody good game. If you're gonna have,
I know, but the idea that game would come out relatively quickly when there were so many systems involved, like, they got after it fast.
Well, it was like a year and a bit, right? Into its life, I think that they got those. So yeah, it's pretty quick compared to, like, I'm still fucking waiting for F-Zero X. God damn it, just do it!
Really? You and everybody else.
It's like, I just want,
there would be dancing in the
streets, I've got the cartridge of that, but I'm ready. You know, I'm ready to buy it again. This is where I kind of agree with in terms of some of the sentiment in the emails we've had. Like, I'm not sure whether Nintendo wants my money as much as they should. In terms of, like, the sale is waiting to be made.
These do kind of, again, it's almost like I planned these emails next to each other.
A little bit of dovetailing.
Yeah, this is a situation where, I mean, I'm the worst person to speak about this topic because you can go back to my constant, like, God damn you, Capcom, I hate you.
Yeah, the X.
I own Mega Man Zero four times. It only came out on three systems. Think about that.
Yeah, the X games coming out, you know, on
it's a disaster
multiple
for me.
Times now, and they're probably certainly are coming out in Japan on new 3DS, aren't they? I'm not sure whether we'll get them.
Ace Attorney games I had a bunch of times. But like, I would buy if to me the question is, would this stop me from buying indie games to give Nintendo the opportunity to give my money for Ogre Battle 64 again? Like, here's another $12. Is that going to stop me from buying something like A-Train City Simulator, which isn't an indie game, I understand, but it just happens to be that. I think that game is $12, and I was thinking about it earlier today. which makes me the only person on Earth who was thinking about that game earlier today, but that's fine.
James,
I don't think it would. But it's hard to say because sometimes I just go to the eShop and I know I've got to talk about a game today and I just flip through. Now, like, I know that, like, we've got a recording in 2 days. I need to find a game. But I think for that specific kind of narrative that we're doing, like, we go and find something weird, something that people have, like Legend of River King for the Game Boy. Just something to talk about that's different. But for the average consumer who's just sitting there like, I want to play a game. Oh, hey, I haven't played, you know, at Guillaume's point, I played this game 8 years ago when it came out on the Wii. You can now be nostalgic for the time you bought that game because you were feeling nostalgic for it. Like, that's the weird, that's the weird boomeranging that's going on now.
Nostalgia
things have gotten so
squared.
Things have gotten into that weird, strange place where you can be double nostalgic for a game. And yeah, that's that's probably okay. But it's certainly a strange place. And I could see that maybe in that case, it does deprive other original titles of sales. I would also argue that... Go ahead.
No, you please finish.
I was going to say something a little bit darker, but I would also say that there is this kind of weird... this weird set of games that's coming out in their digital space that just makes me not want to go into their digital space, where it's just like, I go to what's new and it's like, oh, there's 7 new DSiWare games today. Great. And they're all from that one German publisher who can't stop themselves. Perfect. All right, let me breeze through this shit. Like, there is this... I just feel like if they organize their stuff better, you could probably drive down the potential of this being a problem.
Well, I mean, they've definitely got better about that kind of stuff. I feel like the eShop and the storefronts and all that, it's got a lot better for, you know, highlighting these sorts of games that Ash is talking about that, you know, maybe you might buy, you know, because it gives you a similar kind of enjoyment to maybe classic Nintendo games, and therefore there might be some rivalry between them for your, you know, your spending money on games. But I would say also, you know, he says in the construction of the question, like, well, if the VC games were, you know, available for free, or there was a minor fee like you had from Wii to Wii U, you know, that he wouldn't have had a decision to make. But also, you know, like I said, I mean, I guess that means that you'd be spending the time playing Mario World instead, but you wouldn't be spending the money, or at least most of the money. So you could argue that, you know, the fact that they're full price actually, you know, makes it, might make this problem worse, that, you know, people, you know, because they're paying, you know, the Guillaume said, you know, these are our people paying the full whack for Super Mario World. And the fact that they are is mopping up dollars that could have gone on indie games. So you could kind of make the other argument, really, that if we had, you know, kind of more robust cross-buy and all that, and people weren't buying these games as many times as they are, then that would have actually helped sales of indie games that kind of try to appeal to us on a similar level as classic Nintendo games. So that's, you know, getting into a whole other sort of area of the kind of behavioural, you know, the sort of behavioural mechanics of people, you know, what is the bigger sort of resource constraint, time or money? Well, that varies by the person.
Yeah. I did do a little bit of digging on this. I tasked Neil with doing a little bit of digging on this. Just to get an understanding of what cross-buy means right now, just to discuss this as a viable thing. And generally speaking, we're only talking in the context of indies. I don't know of any virtual console game that's done this, but
well, it was the, not virtual console, but it was the what Nintendo did was the Mario versus DK, wasn't it? That was cross-buy.
Yep. So we reached out to Jules over at Renegade Kid, Jules Watchem, and just asked, what does it take to do a cross-buy? And basically, it's just paperwork. You fill out some paperwork and it happens, and your game becomes cross-buy on the 3DS and the Wii U. So I wonder if, like, it feels like they should be able to do it with a virtual console then. So maybe it is just to Greg's point, it's just not expected right now on Wii U and 3DS, so they're not doing it. That when NX rolls around, maybe it's you know, the time is now right.
It's yeah, a feature, you know, like, you know, it's a, you know, a convergence, you know, our handhelds and our portables have become one, and you can have both, and you've got all your games on both of them or whatever, you know,
it's a selling point for the hardware.
We're making a hell of a lot of assumptions about what it might be there that are made
right,
well.
We are.
Very little, but we have little choice, as we've said many times. But I feel like this idea that Nintendo's done, they've done it before of like, you know, sharpening distinctions between platforms that they didn't really have to be that way, but they're going to make it that way to say this is the next step, you know, even though like they could easily have done more on the previous platform.
John?
I mean, I think there is something to it, though, that that the Nintendo audience just really hasn't been primed for it. I mean, so people aren't expecting it. And so it's almost like you have to
take the money and run.
Yeah, it just seems like people aren't expecting it, and it's almost like you have to go out of your way to advertise cross-buy. Whereas, you know, on other platforms, people expect it. So people are like, what? It doesn't have cross-buy? Whereas with Nintendo platforms, they're like, oh, it does have cross-buy. So it's at this point, it's almost more effort because it's not, I mean, you can do it now, but it hasn't been baked in historically. So it just seems like you have to advertise that fact more than you would on other platforms. So it's probably why some people don't bother.
Sure. Until we had a proper system that could really effectively do cross-buy with the Vita and PS3, it really, even there, they had to go through that cycle of like, no. You buy it once, it's on both.
Yeah.
Like it's tied to both platforms. Cause the PSP really wasn't doing that I guess it did it for different PlayStation games, original PlayStation games.
Yeah, you could play PS1 games on PSP.
Yeah, I think those had cross buy, but that was probably the extent of it because I don't think there were a lot of games on, maybe there were some on PSP that showed up on PS3 as well.
Yeah, and I mean conceptually too, Nintendo was a lot newer to the unified account game. So right.
It's all been tied to the hardware.
Always.
And that's going to be hopefully the difference with NX, and then that could be the sort of launch pad for, okay, you know, now you should expect cross-buy type stuff. Although I would say, you know, in terms of what Ash talks about, you know, the side grade, you know, there was the upgrade thing from Wii to Wii U, you know, that was not paying full freight if you'd bought that particular game on the Wii Shop channel, you know, then you could upgrade for, you know, just a sort of a fraction.
DSi did let you move them directly, to be fair. DSi to 3DS, except for right. Swapnote.
Yeah, but so, you know, I mean, there's some expectation there of not having from Nintendo's history, of not having to pay, you know, the 100% again, which is why I think people have been a bit cheesed off with this new 3DS stuff with the Super Nintendo games. But that's what's going to be interesting, isn't it? You know, when you go to NX, is it going to, you know, sort of hew to the, you know, Wii to Wii U kind of philosophy of like, well, it's a console again, so, you know, we kind of make it a partial upgrade fee? Or is it going to hew to the, well, it's on a different kind of format now, so pay full price that you've seen with the 3DS?
Well, I think we're going to have to cut it there. We actually ran longer than I planned. I do this every time. But if you want to send us your email, RFN@NintendoWorldReport.com. We say it every week. We will be doing, as our end music this week, in memoriam, although it's not technically dead yet, in pre-memoriam, the theme of the DSiWare shop, which I would imagine many of you probably haven't heard before. It's actually like really kind of good. You know, we talk about that the shop music Nintendo has a lot of love put into it. That sounds gross and cheesy, I'm sorry. Has a lot of thought put into it, and it you know, it goes back to this. You know, the Wii Shop Channel's music sounded like you were in a convenience store in Japan. This one is like, you know, proper music. It's not bad. But on that, it's time to end the show. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. I always have to stay. I was waiting for John to go. I've got to be last for some reason.
I think he's trying to prep, frantically trying to prep the Mitomo.
Oh, God! Oh, no. What, John, just...
Guillaume is disappointed in you. It's the podcast people. Currently, he is a sexy man.
I'm done.
Yes, you are.
Me too, John. Me too. Bye,
yes,
everybody.
You've been rendered obsolete, John. That's right.